Hi, everyone. This is Alicia Halliday, and this is the ASF Weekly Science Podcast. Now, the hottest topic right now in autism is marijuana. We featured it on the Day of Learning last year, and I promised a podcast about it this year. But I think most listeners get the basic gist. When families talk about the marijuana plant and cannabis, though, they might be talking about two different things. The first is the plant, which contains both THC and cannabinoids. THC is what gets you high, and on the other hand, cannabinoids, or CBD, are not psychoactive but do seem to have some effects on anxiety. Last year, a drug was approved by the FDA for treatment of seizures in something called Dravet syndrome. The drug is called Epidiolex. The main ingredient in this drug is cannabidiol, or CBD. But because CBD comes from the marijuana plant, even though it has no psychoactive substance in it, technically, the use of CBD is illegal. The reason you see it in stores being sold is through a small loophole in something called the 2014 Farm Bill. This bill basically allows hemp farmers to sell hemp. Hemp, in case you didn't know, is a product of the cannabis plant as well, with no psychoactive properties. So this Farm Bill allows hemp to be cultivated and researched because it doesn't have a certain amount of THC in it. Now, technically, there are still about 10 states where you cannot make hemp and you cannot make or sell CBD. It doesn't really matter where they are, though, because now there's something called the internet, which means if you want CBD oil, you can get it. Drug laws aside, there are parents and people with autism who say that marijuana in edibles with THC, smoked, baked, whatever, helps their autism symptoms. Maybe through easing anxiety, maybe through some other mechanism, and they use it. When I say maybe through some other mechanism, it's because we know very little about why either THC or CBD is effective in helping anyone. Technically, it cannot be researched. The scientists that examined Epidiolex for the FDA, which was used to treat seizures, had to jump through all sorts of hoops. Even in states like California, where you can go into a store and you buy it if you're over 21, it's still almost impossible to study it. Not only is it technically illegal, it's also in this gray area of what's called a complementary and alternative medicine, where there's absolutely no evidence that it works. In the case of THC, it's illegal to study, so therefore, there's no evidence. It's a difficult situation, of course. But states like in Oregon and California, where it can be purchased recreationally, parents are still hesitant to discuss the option with their doctor. So can you imagine what it's like in, say, Florida, New Jersey, and New York for parents to talk to their doctors about the use of either CBD or THC for the treatment of autism? So how should doctors handle these questions about the use, the dose of marijuana or CBD? Now, doctors get these questions all the time, and ASF gets them. In the case of marijuana or THC-containing products, I can't even suggest a dose because there's no dosing information. I can't even suggest doing it because there's no scientific evidence. And what's worse, even if I could suggest a dose, where in New Jersey would you go to get the right dose? What brownie do you eat? What strain do you smoke? I have no clue. So no evidence, so I really can't give them any answers. I do have a little bit more guidance with CBD based on what other people are telling me, but it's really inadequate. So imagine being a clinician, wanting to develop a good rapport with a family, and the family comes to you and says that they want to try something that's unproven and illegal. The unproven part, these doctors have some experience with. Evidence has shown that it's important for clinicians to discuss things openly and not be overly dismissive. And this includes things like vitamins. It includes yoga, horse therapy, all these different complementary alternative medicines that have very little or no evidence. So keeping that in mind, how should they be open and accepting of marijuana use? Recently, in the Journal of Pediatrics, which is the official journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, published a set of opinions from pediatricians based on the ethics of communication and their personal experiences. This is not a position statement. This is just a group of pediatricians expressing their experiences and what they think it's ethical to do. But it was published in the journal Pediatrics. Here's what they had to say. Of course, marijuana is a complementary and alternative medicine. In one way, it should be treated as any other one, vitamins, yoga, massage, which means that families should be asked about any unmet medical needs which they have, which may have turned them to a complementary medicine to begin with. They need to review with them what their current plan is, when what's working and what's not working. So there are some complementary medicines that fall into the category of safe with little or no evidence. These are things like yoga. And there are some that are unsafe. They include chelation or hyperbaric oxygen. Instead of discouraging those that are probably safe but may or may not be effective, it's okay to monitor them. It's okay to allow families to tell them what they're doing. It's okay for families to have an open relationship and for doctors to not judge. While the AAP opposes medical cannabis for children, they also recognize that it may be an option for children with life-limiting or severely debilitating conditions for whom current therapies are inadequate. That's from their statement. That is, cannabis is not the first option, but it may be a later option, and it may be a later option for severely debilitating effects like self-harm and self-injury. These doctors say if evidence is insufficient to point to clear benefits of harm, in other words, if it seems okay safety-wise, the clinician should engage in a shared decision-making approach, and this should include the family's perspective. Because evidence points to negative THC effects on developing brains, it's probably prudent to advise against or to recommend caution when thinking about THC preparations, especially to children. Evidence is insufficient to support the efficacy or adverse events in CBD in children with ASD. Remember, CBD is non-psychoactive. So the clinicians should communicate with parents about what is known and unknown and the effects of cannabis on children, including both THC and CBD. There should be a clear line here. Given that a child has tried conventional ASD therapies, and that may include medicines and ABA, without significant improvement, and this may be the last line of hope, CBD use has been associated with reduced self-harm, it would be ethically inappropriate for the clinician to advise against CBD use. So these are Oregon pediatricians, so in fact they can advise in dosing because they know exactly how much CBD or THC is in a plant and edible a lotion. In fact, they advise to ask about dosages, and they also recognize that what we can all come together on is that there needs to be more research. This may or may not help you when you're talking to your doctor, but the very bottom line is that you really should have an open communication with your primary care physician, whether that be a developmental pediatrician, an internal medicine specialist, a regular pediatrician, about the challenges that you're having and what the benefits and the risks are of both CBD and THC. So what other complementary and alternative medicines need more research? Well, we can debate this. There are plenty of them. But there's a large comprehensive study going on about stem cell therapies. Many families are going to countries with probably inadequate safety or regulatory practices to get stem cell therapy with absolutely no oversight. They report improvements, but are these improvements real? I think I mentioned a while ago that Duke University is conducting a study looking at stem cell treatments in a medically supervised setting. This is IRB approved. It's done in conjunction with medical staff, and they're looking at not only the early safety, but also the efficacy of stem cells obtained from umbilical cord blood. So in the case of the Duke University study, you have to have your own umbilical cord blood stored to be eligible for this study so that there's no need to immunosuppress. Kids with cancer get immunosuppressed because they need these stem cells to live, and sometimes their parents don't bank them when they're born, and they have to go out and get maybe an imperfect match. This means that they have to be immunosuppressed to prevent the body from actually attacking these new stem cells that are infused. In this Duke University study, they've eliminated that by only allowing people to participate if their child has stem cells through their umbilical cord blood already banked somewhere. Using comprehensive protocols and a strict oversight of medical doctors, the study so far is called what's a single-arm open label. That means that doctors and patients and their families all know what they're getting. They're all getting stem cells. Nobody's getting the control. The open label part means that the doctor knows what they're getting. The family knows what they're getting. Randomized controlled studies actually eliminate this. They randomly assign people to either a control arm or a treatment arm. And in this case, the investigators really wanted to look at the safety and feasibility and primary efficacy before they moved on to a randomized control trial. The investigators acknowledged that there could be some bias here, and we all know there could be some bias here. This was a very, very early study, and it was done in a medically supervised setting. So a new paper came out about this study, and while the results are promising, it's tempered with, of course, the fact that there's no comparison group. The data may not represent real improvements because of the therapy, but because of changes over time, which include normally. Also, my excitement was tempered by the fact that everybody knew what everybody was getting, which may skew the results a bit. The placebo effect, which is what people and parents may see if they even think they're getting a treatment, is a real thing in autism. It's a real thing in many, many mental illnesses. So it's important to get the perspective not only from families, but also from trained clinicians, which they do here. I'll summarize. The researchers at Duke University found there were improvements in socialization and vocabulary, which correlated to more brain regions known to be involved in social behavior and language. This all sounds great, but because there was no control arm, it may have actually had nothing to do with the stem cell transplant. And because this was Duke, I highly doubt the families were prevented. In fact, they were probably encouraged to go receive behavioral interventions, which do have more established efficacy. So the improvements may have had nothing to do with the stem cell therapy. Now, these studies are hard. I certainly would never enroll my daughter in a study that would disallow her from going to OT or receive any other sort of interventions. So I get it. This study does have limitations. And the authors of the study all acknowledge these limitations. So I'm not saying that they're trying to hide anything. There's some concern, at least by me, however, that people may not read through the entire study and understand these limitations and the conditions of their findings. So they immediately see promise with no caveats, which is why I'm describing them here. It's a hard line to manage. Do you do the study to protect those who are going to foreign countries anyway because they say, oh, it works because there's no data otherwise? Or do you not do the study because it's impossible to do perfectly and you're really going to fall short the first time around? It's tough. What I can say is don't go to a foreign country to get a stem cell transplant. Call Duke University if you want to. Seriously, see what they can do for you first. They're professionals. They are doctors. They have done this before and they know what to look for. They will get you whatever help or services you need. Or try and call us. We'll help if we can. Thanks for listening and I'll talk to you next week.